You're listening to Office Hours, a series of curious conversations with Belfer Center experts. I sat down with Steven Pinker, an experimental psychologist and author of several best-selling books, including The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. He is a John Stone Family Professor in the Department of Psychology at Harvard University.
So you study language, and how did you get involved in language? How did you know you wanted to study it? Were you a talker as a kid? Did you crush sentence diagramming in middle school? What was it?
It wasn't that, although I've always had an interest in language. Really, language was a topic in cognitive psychology, and that was my specialty. My PhD thesis was not on language. It was on visual imagery, how we visualize objects in three-dimensional space, mentally rotate them, imagine what they look like from other vantage points. And a lot of my research has been on visual cognition, how we recognize shapes and faces, how we allocate visual attention across the visual field. And language was just is one of many topics in cognitive psychology, but it was the one where I think the world told me that it found what I was doing most interesting. And so I specialized more and more in language.
Now with shapes, that seems also mathematical, topological. Did you also study a lot of math? Was that required?
I did study math, and indeed much of my interest in language came from the mathematical elegance of syntax. Noam Chomsky, the famous MIT linguist and political commentator for that matter, as well as proposing a theory of how English syntax works, he did some early work on the mathematics of different classes of grammars. What are possible languages? How do you even define a language mathematically? How do you capture what we all intuitively sense to be its beauty, its symmetry, its expressive power? And one of my earliest contributions to language was trying to understand how language acquisition works, how kids acquire their first language in a kind of mathematical framework. What problem are kids solving when they figure out how English works, not being born with any expectation of any particular language, but perhaps being born with an expectation of how language in general works.
You've also written a book on language and on style, the sense of style. What are your thoughts and feelings on the word like? do you like it?
As a filler like? It's not as new as people think. When I was a child, it was already an issue in the 1960s.
This is a rage. Yeah.
And in fact, there was a television program aimed at the burgeoning teenage market, the baby boomers in their youth in Canada, where I grew up, called Like Young. And that was the show in which you could see teenagers dancing to pop songs. So even in the 60s, it was considered a hallmark of the speech of the young. So it's certainly not a 21st century phenomenon.
So it's not a corruption?
Well, it's a... I just started my sentence with well, yeah. And we all have a set of fillers that indicate that we have not yet surrendered the floor, even if the gears of our mind are churning to come up with the next word or the next phrase. We need some way of signaling, I'm not done yet, it's not your turn, not your turn to talk.
What about curse words?
Well, I've done an entire chapter on the phenomenon of swearing in my book, The Stuff of Thought.
Does Canada have different curse words than America?
Well, French Canada in particular. Oh, and they are the Québécois are very proud of the fact that the worst thing you could say to someone would be translated as accursed tabernacle. Accursed tabernacle. Oh. Maudit tabernacle.
That's as a guess.
Actually, maybe what might be even worse is accursed chalice. Maudit chalice. And which shows that swearing needn't be restricted to scatological or sexual terms in many cultures, especially Catholic ones. It's religious terms that are the source of curse words.
Really?
Yeah.
In what way?
Well, if the and in fact, we even in English we say things like, you know, goddamn and Jesus Christ,
right,
which used to be pretty racy. Now they've become so acceptable, we don't hardly consider them curse words anymore. But the fact that people say gosh, golly, gee whiz, gee willikers, jumpin' Jehoshaphat, ways of censoring themselves in mid-curse shows that at some point there was some taboo around religious cursing. Basically, anything that can convey a strong negative emotion, whether it be disgust at bodily effluvia, repugnance at depraved sexual practices, such as copulating with one's mother. Dread of death and disease. In many languages, the curse words come from disease or death, as in the Polish and Yiddish curse cholera, cholera. Or fear and awe of a divinity, and the possibility that you might be provoking the unwanted attention of the Almighty by taking his name in vain. So anything that can evoke a strong negative emotion is a candidate for a curse word in one or another language.
Do you feel technology has helped or ruined our vocabulary, our way of speech? It's corrupted. Is Twitter the enemy? How do you feel about technology?
Technology is not going to be the ruin of the language, although there have been fears like that expressed since the invention of writing, where that was thought to be the...
They thought the tablet was just going to ruin everything.
And by tablet, they do not mean... We don't mean the iPad.
Right.
We mean like when you say
it's... Stone tablet.
Like when, you know, it's not carved in stone. Well, back then it was carved in stone. And yes, the papyrus and so on were considered to be the... to corrupt the arts of memory. Then it was telegraphy. The telegrams are going to ruin the language, especially since people had to leave out the prepositions in the articles because you paid by the word, and telegrams were expensive. And so you had, you know, meet station 5, and people feared that this would lead to the corruption of English syntax. And then, of course, radio, then in my youth, television, and now social media. And the reason that it doesn't corrupt the language is that there's no such thing as the language. We all have different forms of language that we use in different contexts. We speak differently when we're orating in front of a crowd, when we are composing a term paper or an op-ed, when we're addressing a spouse and we're talking to a child. And we develop a form of language that's suitable to 140 characters or a telegram in our grandparents' day. And we all master these different forms of speech that we use in different contexts. So the fact that we leave out words or use abbreviations in one register doesn't mean that we are incapable of using them in another register.
So there's a good and bad associated with all these different platforms of language. There's good Twitter speak and bad Twitter speak. There's good email writing, there's bad. There's good letter writing, etc.
Absolutely.
Is that the idea?
And the rumor that students are using text messaging abbreviations and little smiley faces in their term papers turns out to be a false.
It's not true. That
a large survey of term papers. So the students have an idea of what's appropriate.
Well, let's talk about kids. And let's talk about teenagers. And they seem to be very creative. They have all these slangs. I was told, of last year or two, the word bae, for instance. I don't know if you're familiar with bae.
No, B-A-Y.
It's another, B-A-E.
Oh, B-A-E.
It's another word for your boo, or your baby, your babe.
Oh,
your,
bae meaning your
partner.
Romantic partner?
Yes, romantic partner.
Okay, yeah.
Before anyone else is what
yes.
it stands for.
Oh, I see.
There's
okay.
Another one they say.
I had not heard that one.
On fleek, which is, fleek, which is not even a word, but on fleek means on point. And I think, I heard from a friend the other day that they don't even say, so a lot of times they won't say good anymore. They'll say Gucci.
Uh-huh.
So they'll say like, oh, are you Gucci? What's Gucci?
Uh-huh.
And you'll say, I'm Gucci.
Okay. I've just learned something.
Do you have to keep up? Well, how do you keep up with the slang? Or do you keep up with the slang?
Apparently I don't. If this conversation is any guide.
So, but with some of these things, you mentioned that, you mentioned emojis. Now, even if students aren't using them in their term papers, if students are using, a lot of times they're not texting anymore, they're Snapchatting, which is just, some sort of an image of themselves or a place, or they're sending emojis, they're transitioning away from words in some of their communications with each other. That seems to be something new, or is that...
No, actually, I don't know if that's true. Remember, the earlier generations used the telephone, and telephone usage is falling. Something that the phone companies are all too well aware of. More than ever, we express ourselves in the written word, in texts, in emails, in comments, in user reviews. Probably people are writing more now than perhaps at any time in history.
Do you read every day?
Oh, massively, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, that's probably the thing, the activity that I do most.
In leisure reading, how much might you read in a day? What's your day look like?
Oh, I wouldn't even know how to estimate. I wake up reading, I go to bed reading.
And it's all the same. So fiction, science, journals, books?
I read very little fiction, which is an embarrassing concession for the husband of a novelist.
Okay.
Rebecca Goldstein has written eight works of fiction.
I hope you've read her books.
I have certainly read her books.
Okay. So I want to transition a little bit to the book that you wrote on violence and mm-hmm. war. You've written on violence and war, but you went from studying kids and language and the brain to violence
and
irregular, harmless things like irregular verbs to...
I get much more hate mail about irregular verbs than I do about war, genocide, and rape.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Why did you do that? Why did you make that transition?
Yes. The common thread is human nature. What makes us tick? Why do we do the things that we do? Why do we speak? Why do we speak in certain ways? But also, why do we fight? Why do we... fall in love? Why are we sexually attracted to other people? Why are we afraid of some things? Why do we find some things easy to remember and others hard? So that's a great thing about being a psychologist. All of human experience is in your purview. In the case of language of violence, I had written a book called How the Mind Works, followed up by a book called The Blank Slate, which argued for the existence of human nature. We're not blank slates. We aren't passive media that society and culture and parents write upon. We are products of evolution. We are born with certain talents and temperaments and fears and drives. And I had to deal with the fact that that itself is a politically controversial statement, that there are many people who feel that it would be so much nicer if we were blank slates, because then all of the nasty, ugly traits that people develop, like revenge, like jealousy, like lust, like dominance, we could make them go away if we just brought up children in a different world or changed the messages in our advertising. And that there's a perception that there's something fatalistic, maybe even reactionary, about the whole idea of human nature. And it's probably true that on average, more conservative political ideologies tend to have more of a robust conception of human nature, and more utopian progressive ones tend to fantasize that we're malleable and therefore hope we have the hope for...
Well, what do you think? So you think human nature is... There is such a thing as human nature.
There is such a thing as human nature. So that's what leads us to violence. Namely, I made the argument in these books that that in fact it is a mistake to assume that human nature exists, we are doomed to perpetual strife and conflict, because human nature is complex. It has many parts. That is one of the my conception of human nature that I have always advocated is that the mind is a heterogeneous, complex system. There's not just one thing in the head, but we have motives that compete against each other. And in particular, we have an ability to think up new ideas, share them via language, which is open-ended, it's infinite. And that brings us back to the algorithmic rule-governed component of language and of thought. Namely, you can always take old ideas, combine them to create new ideas, and share them.
So sometimes we can be warlike and sometimes we can be peace-like.
Not only that, but we can, at the same time, we can be tempted to fight, but restrain those impulses. We can allow the better angels of our nature, in Abraham Lincoln's poetic term, to prevail,
book, right?
And also the name of the book. And so what I pointed out briefly in those two books is that not only can we change social arrangements by having some parts of human nature outsmart others, but in fact we have. If you look at human history, there hasn't been a constant level of violence throughout. The Soviet Empire fell almost entirely peacefully. We've abolished slavery and gruesome forms of capital punishment, like breaking on the wheel. That rates of homicide have fallen throughout European history. So I threw out those points. At one point, I reiterated them in a blog post that posed the question, what are you optimistic about? And I said, well, look at these examples of how we've overcome high rates of violence. And then I started getting correspondence from political scientists, criminologists, psychologists saying, you could have added to the list of historical declines of violence. I heard from Andrew Mack at the Human Security Research Project in Vancouver that we've been tracking rates of war and have found that rates of war and deaths in war have gone down since the end of World War II. I heard from historical criminologists who said, you noted that homicide has gone down in England. It's not just in England. It's also Germany and Switzerland and the Netherlands and Italy.
And so the point is that violence, the title of your book was, we've written many, but this one was The Better Angels of Our Nature. The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined.
Yeah.
And the reasons are what? We have both inner demons and we have better angels.
Yep.
And depending on the circumstances, and those demons and angels are determined by human nature. But
yes.
the nurture aspect, or say the environment or the circumstances, will perhaps benefit or prioritize one of those or inspire one of those more than the other. Is that the
basic
idea?
Exactly. And that over the course of history, we've become better at figuring out how to implement institutions and norms that bring out our better angels.
So we've been consciously making it better.
Well, sometimes consciously, sometimes unconsciously, but keeping the things that work. Recognizing that things that we may have introduced for one reason have a beneficial side effect, so let's keep them. So just to give you some examples. Most obvious is government. When the first governments were implemented, they weren't particularly benevolent organizations. They practiced slavery and human sacrifice and conscription and so on. But people began to realize that it's better to have a government than to live in anarchy. They began to domesticate government, make it more democratic. And it is an institution that, for all its flaws, as Hobbes pointed out, keeps us from each other's throats. Namely, if I know that if I attack someone, then police will haul me off and throw me in jail, I might be less tempted to attack someone. But even more importantly, I will recognize that the other guy is less tempted to attack me, so I don't have to maintain a belligerent stance to deter him and establish the credibility of my deterrent. So everyone is calmed down when you have third-party adjudicators. Commerce. That can make violence less tempting, because if there's an infrastructure of commerce, if there are financial institutions like money, if there are contracts and roads and container ships and so on, it becomes cheaper to buy things than to steal them, and other people become more valuable to you alive than dead. And so that's another way in which two different routes of getting rich, namely plunder and reciprocal trade, are available, but if trade is cheaper and more available, you go for the reciprocal exchange. Another is the possibility that as the world becomes more cosmopolitan, as we rub shoulders with more and more people who aren't like us, as we see their lives depicted in films and novels and on the news, it's the part of human psychology that can divide the in-group from the out-group and then dehumanize or demonize the out-group is kind of down-regulated. We're more likely to see people who aren't like us as within our circle.
And that's kind of where language comes in, say, cultural norms being exported. Is the pen mightier than the sword?
I think it can be, yeah, because we haven't been crossing swords at a constant rate through history, and the overall trend is less sword, more pen.
And certainly if violence can decline, violence can also incline increase.
And at some points in history, it has. There in the 1960s, there was both an increase in homicide domestically, that the crime rate went through the roof. Thanks to my generation, the baby boomers, we were, despite all this peace and love stuff, we were an unusually violent generation when it comes to crime. Internationally, there was a big increase in the number of civil wars in the 1960s with decolonization and the rise of, and the Cold War and the rise of Marxist insurgencies and right-wing reactions. So those are two examples in which violence increased. Both of them came back down to earth. But sure, there is no inexorable force or mysterious arc of justice or Hegelian dialectic that magically moves us toward nonviolence. It's just that if you're clever about it, you can try solutions and some of them will work, and you try to stick with the ones that do work. In terms of homicide and crime, I think it's likely that it'll continue to decrease, because contrary to the widespread belief in the 60s that increased violence was just systemic, that there are root causes like poverty and racism, and until you eliminate the root causes, violence is inevitable. We now know that is utterly false. That crime, violent crime, plummeted starting in the 1990s with no decrease in inequality and with plenty of racism around. The other hotbeds of seemingly intractable crime have been managed to bring the rate down. Rio, Bogota, Medellin, Colombia. And if you focus on violence as something that you try to reduce with systematic efforts and evidence-based policy, we now know that we can do so. With that knowledge, I think it's completely feasible to reduce homicide by 50% in 30 years. That's a target that was announced by University of Cambridge and World Health Organization, and I don't think that's utopian.
Better Angels of Our Nature, you wrote that book in, is it 2011?
Yes.
It was 2011. So, of course, that was pre-ISIS and pre-Libya and Ukraine. It was also pre-Trump.
Mm-hmm.
If Trump wins the presidency, will you take it all back?
Well, no. First of all, Trump's not going to win the presidency. But no, because I don't think we're going to bring back human sacrifice. I don't think we're going to bring back legal slavery. I think that is a panic reaction from... from a lot of the left and the intelligentsia. I think Trump presidency would be horrible, but it's not going to lead to genocide in World War III.
But this idea of a loss of empathy.
Yeah.
Because one of the theses is that our circles of empathy are increasing, and so there's an anti-violence norm that is expanding among society, that we're thinking less about our tribe, our local state. Maybe even less of our country, with say Trumpism or whatever we want to call it, or the xenophobia in Europe, or the refugee crises around the world that are happening with respect to Syria, are those signaling that this process is not exactly a steady decline? There are some bumps in the road.
Oh, it's not a steady decline. There are always, for one thing, 7 billion people aren't all going to feel the same thing at any point in history. And so in talking about historical trends, we're averaging over an awful lot of different people's opinions and sensibilities in different countries and so on. And there's always a foaming beneath the surface. I think what we've seen in Trumpism, in part, is a voice given to a certain sector in society that's probably always grumbled about certain social trends, such as the empowerment of women, such as the decriminalization of homosexuality, and globalization, cosmopolitanism. And Trump has managed to give them a voice. But there's still a minority of American society. And even if he were to become president, fortunately, we do have a system of checks and balances where, assuming he doesn't appoint himself Führer, he's not going to be able to do everything that he wants to do. This is not to rule out the possibility that there can be backsliding or reversals. There absolutely can be.
What is the research on kids and violent video games? Are violent video games, are those desensitizing kids to violence?
No.
Or are they, sublimation, the idea that you can you channel those basic urges into safe and socially acceptable channels?
I think it's neither. If consuming violent media made you violent, then we should prevent adults from reading the Iliad, or for that matter, the Old Testament, together with Shakespearean tragedies and Godfather movies and much else.
Surely reading Shakespeare is different than like shooting people on a screen, right?
Not necessarily, because in Shakespeare you have a lot of... violence that is presented as justified and that gives you satisfaction. The data show that video games have skyrocketed in popularity during exactly the historical period in which violent crime has sunk to the floor, and in the same age cohorts. I don't think it's because that we have some hydraulic urge to violence that has to be channeled through one conduit lest it burst out into another, but it is. So partly these are independent developments. Partly the beneficial effect of video games may just be that if you're playing video games, you're not getting into trouble in other ways. And so the young men who are behind a screen are not out picking fights in bars or over parking spots. So I think the connection is much more pedestrian.
It's tenuous, it sounds like, yeah. Between any.
But certainly the moral panic over video games is entirely misplaced. What determines crime is much more quality of policing, availability of alcohol, availability of weapons in particular places and times.
And the threat of terrorism is, well, people feel the threat of terrorism a lot.
Yeah.
Should they?
No.
Why not?
Except for nuclear terrorism. We should take reasonable safeguards to make sure that fissionable material is not so available that that the popular front for whatever can build a nuclear weapon. Aside from that, the death toll from terrorism is far below other risks that we happily tolerate, like not just cars, but electrocution, falling off ladders, medical errors, poisoning.
Those are all more dangerous.
Drownings are far more dangerous than terrorism in terms of the number of deaths per year. Terrorism is almost by definition a fear of implementing technique. That is, you try to commit violence in such a spectacular and newsworthy way with victims that are so sympathetic and innocent that the news media can't turn their attention away, and it gets repeated on the news cycle to draw attention to a cause. But what it means is that in consuming this news, we should keep it in perspective, that not only is it not an existential threat, but it's not even a particularly large threat, and moreover, has not been increasing. Outside of war zones, there are fewer deaths per terrorism now than there were in the heyday of left-wing terrorism in the 1970s, when there's the Red Brigades and the Baader-Meinhof gang and the IRA and so on, which actually killed more people than are being killed today by ISIS, outside of war zones like in Iraq and Syria itself.
Now, you said you're always under contract if you're writing a book, so you're working on something right now. And I read that it was an expansion of your 2013 New Republic piece, which seemed to be a defense of science.
Yeah.
Science seems to be doing pretty well. What needs defending?
Scientific thinking isn't doing so well. That is evidence-based reasoning in everything from crime to politics to medicine. This is not an expansion. This is not a call for more funding for science, although I happen to think that would be a good thing. But rather that the ethos of science, namely, you try to explain things, you try to show whether your beliefs are false, you acknowledge how staggeringly difficult it is to know anything about anything and try very, very hard to figure out how things work, ought to be exported to the rest of intellectual life. We should be much more evidence-based in everything that we do, and that there are scientific insights to be had or applied in everything from appreciation of the arts to the crafting of policy.
But aren't so many things today data-driven? I feel like big data has been this catchphrase for several years, and it's the way we think about political campaigns, the way we think about military campaigns, the way we think about so many things are so data-driven, all these apps, social media. Are those rejecting the scientific method?
Those are a small, for all the publicity they get, it's still restricted to a very small number of commercial domains. Did the decision to invade Iraq, was that based on big data?
Probably not. Wasn't really based on any data.
Exactly. That's the problem. How should we respond to shootings of civilians by police officers? The vast amount of that commentary is utterly data-free. It's anecdote-driven. It's outrage-driven. It is not based on a count of how often it occurs, nor is it based on trade-offs in terms of how much policing is the optimum amount of policing. So that would be another example. Climate change, certainly. On the one hand, in the American right, there has been an outright denial of the science. But on the left, there's been a fair amount of denialism, too, in terms of reasonable projections as to what steps would actually have some hope of averting catastrophic climate change. What is the proper role of nuclear power, for example?
Are there still things that are going to be outside of science's reach in terms of what they can solve? Can science, you know, tell me how to be happy?
I think it can provide, that psychology and economics can provide insight, yeah. I don't think it'll solve these problems, but these problems may not have solutions because a lot of them involve trade-offs. But it can illuminate them because one can see if I want a little more of this, I might have to accept a little less of that. And why couldn't that be informed by knowledge about what makes people happy and what doesn't?
Do you have a favorite psychological thriller?
Maybe The Godfather.
Yeah?
Yeah. That's life in a state of nature. I think it's one of a number of genres of fiction, such as spy thrillers and westerns that return us to the state that characterized most of human evolution, where we couldn't dial 911 to settle our disputes or file a lawsuit. And we had to strategize about how to deter our adversaries, protect our interests, and there's an infinite number of possibilities.
Well, thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun. Thanks again for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Office Hours was produced by the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.